Tonight on Arena, Will Sharp on his role in Too Much, the new Netflix series from Lena Dunham, and we speak to the directors of the new Irish movie, Horseshoe. Start the word. Here we go. 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. You should have had a little drink before we started, because now I'm suddenly going to get a frog on my throat. I was talking about the horseshoe and that I had walked up around that walk in the west of Ireland, because four siblings gather in a house in the west of Ireland to do what so many families have to do at some point or other, sort out their father's will. And that's at the crux of a film called Horseshoe, debut feature from Adam O'Keefe and Edwin Milan. For the four Canavan siblings, adult siblings, nothing in the process is straightforward. Competing needs and loyalties there all the time, not to mention the fact that their father is actively haunting them and making them second guess everything they thought was real in their lives. Carolyn Bracken, Neil Fleming, Jed Murray, John Connors and the great Laura Ruddy of the dead patriarch Cullum are all part of the cast for Horseshoe. It has its world premiere at the Galway Film Flat this Saturday evening in the Town Hall, a showing that is already sold out, I believe. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by co-director of Horseshoe, Adam O'Keefe, a writer and co-director, Adam O'Keefe, and the other director, co-director, Edwin Milan. 3 hours, lads, for the premiere to sell out. That must have been a pretty nice moment. Who's going to take it?
I thought we were going to have to cram in every family member we've ever met, every person we've ever spoke to at a bus stop. So we were delighted that it sold out so quickly.
Yeah, and you had shown it to some of the directors of the Galway Film Fair at this stage already. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's shot in the west of Ireland, so we thought the Fla would be a great place to show the film, and we've been going to the Fla for many years and been inspired by so many great independent films there. So we were delighted that the directors liked the film too and were very supportive, and that we were chosen to be part of the programme this year.
And yes, you are both from the west of Ireland, and it's very much set in the west of Ireland, up in Sligo Leitrim, amazing landscape that you have as your background. And the horseshoe, there's a specific walk called the horseshoe up that neck of the woods, and that it's mentioned certainly along the way. How would you set out for us, Adam, the dynamic between the four siblings of the Canavan family and the ever-present father?
Well, it was based on the idea that as siblings, you sort of never grow up. The relationships you have when you're younger, when you're young boys or girls as siblings, is sort of the relationship you carry through into your adulthood. So then it was looking at placing that in the crucible. As you said, sooner or later, we all have to deal with the loss of a parent. And how does that stressor affect those relationships? And obviously, without giving any spoilers, this is a family with problems. Mm. And at the core of this is, once the locus of the family in the fact that the parents has been removed, can they still be a family afterwards? Can they still learn to rebond and become something new together?
Yeah, and there's a will. There's a will involved as well here, Edwin.
Yeah, as well as in a particular Irish way of dealing with debt, there's always a bit of dark humour. And certainly when there's something like this to solve, it brings out the best and the worst in the people. And I think it does so in the story too, for sure.
Absolutely. Let's have a listen to the moment in the film when the will is actually read. And John Connors plays the lawyer, the solicitor, who's reading out the will to the assembled family. And to say that there's tension between these four siblings would be to understate matters for sure. But they're certainly not ready for what daddy... Well, for what daddy wants to be done, according to the will that is read to them at any rate. Let's have a listen. And I should warn you, it's a lot of language throughout the film. And there's certainly some pricey reactions from the four siblings as they listen to John Connors as the solicitor reading the will.
The passage of my estate to any or all of my children is dependent on the unanimity of consensus that must be reached, agreed and declared between all parties. This requirement is absolute and without exception. Should a consensus fail to be reached, my wish is that the totality of my estate should pass in full to the state of Ireland as the sole beneficiary.
The state, the fucking state. That fucker would have gave himself syphilis before he paid taxes.
There's not more, is there?
There's one last thing. In the interest of a timely resolution to this matter, I have nominated a deadline for the consensus to be reached. Should a shared agreement not be reached 24 hours after the will has been officially read, then the residuary clause shall come into effect.
Jeez. I bet you fucking loved that little lad on, didn't he?
Yeah, and well, he might laugh. I think, is that Neil Fleming as Niall who's doing most of the laughing there? He's one of the siblings. And I think we heard him speaking in within the midst of that, as well as the older sibling, Jeremiah, who has been at home all the time with the dad. And there's a very particular relationship going on there, played by Jed Murray. We heard the voice of Carolyn Bracken as Cass. Is Cass, by the way, did I hear it right that Cass is a short version of Chastity? Is that the actual name, or did I make that up in my head?
I think made up in your head. Yeah, no, it's good. No, I thought, subliminal.
Surely they didn't call a child Chastity. But anyway, Cass is her name. So I'm glad to hear that she wasn't christened that name. And then there's a fourth sibling in the midst of all of this, Evan, played by Eric O'Brien. One of the things that struck me in both the writing, I thought, Edwin, and in how you both directed it then, so how to go about... Each of the siblings is as likeable and as hateable as each other. They all have their own very specific stories. There's no one dominating, no one story. You're not rooting for one person in particular, maybe one a little bit more than the others. But in general, there's you're quite even-handed. You've divided the spoils equally between all four.
Yeah, I mean, we're very lucky to have worked with an amazing ensemble. I mean, the actors you just mentioned there, they all brought so many ideas and their talents and experience to it as well. But I suppose... our process of making this film is a little bit different than the conventional way. Myself and Adam had workshopped a few ideas about what might work. And then because we were up against a timeline and we had a house in the west of Ireland, we kind of like sculpt the characters and the story around that. We were able to workshop the ideas specifically with the actors. So they brought plenty of their own lives and experiences to it as well. So I think that's what really defines those characters in a way. I mean, we're both lucky enough to have worked with many of the actors in the theatre and in other short films as well. So with great trust and measure of them and what they could do and what they could bring to the characters as well.
And you had met Adam, yourself and Edwin, had met at AADT. You were studying film, I presume, there, were
no,
you?
No, we're studying English Media and Cultural Studies. So it was one of these great courses. It's like a fantastic course, but it doesn't train you for anything. So you had to sort of find your own way after college.
It trained you to find your own way.
So we started making theatre together. So we made theatre together for a few years and then we pivoted into film.
And that pivot in towards film, Edwin, it's not an easy, because, you know, a play, if you have a cast, a script and a space, you can put it on for relatively little money. You mightn't make too much money, but it can be done. A film, even a micro-budget film, demands more money than most people have in their back pocket.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think about when we started making things together. And straight out of college, I remember us in the upstairs of the International Bar for putting our first play on together. And we had a stage and we just had to put a story out there. And you think that's the beauty of theatre, where you can tell stories so quickly. But certainly for something of a feature film, there's just so many moving parts. It's so technical in ways that it's a lot to bite off, and you need a lot of collaboration to bring a film together, you know.
And the shorts that you had worked on before this, what were they, Adam? And how would you say they fed into this? Was there a short version of this story, really, or at least the characters?
Well, one of the great things about the shorts we did is we ended up working with most of the cast through our shorts, and we worked with a lot of our crew through our shorts. So that created the crucible through which we could actually achieve a longer form thing when it comes to the feature. So for this feature in particular, we had a nub of an idea that was an unfilmed short script that was a horror, which was about a whale, had a brother and a sister, but it was a horror, it was 10 minutes, it was very, very different. So when the opportunity came to shoot a feature, it was actually the location and the cast and the crew that came before the story. So we took those circumstances and we wrote the story to what the circumstances were in front of us. So that's where then that nub idea became something entirely different, as Ed is saying, in collaboration with the actors in particular.
Yeah, and so we've mentioned the four siblings played by Jed Murray, Eric O'Brien, Carolyn Bracken and Neil Fleming. There's also then the dad, who has died, but he's here in the film. People can work that out as they go along how he's there, but he's here in the film. And there's another character, important character, a couple of important characters. Not this one is Tony, played by Mary Murray. And this is from quite early on in the film. And we'll hear Jed Murray here again as Jeremiah. And he's out for a walk and he's having a chat with his dad the way you would. And Tony comes up towards him, played by Mary Murray.
That field is mine.
Was yours.
What's that supposed to mean? What are you doing up here anyway?
Nothing.
It's not nothing. You're up to something.
I'm just walking.
This walk. This is my walk.
You can't own a walk.
Yes, I fucking can. Do you hear me, boy?
Don't touch me.
Do you need another lesson, boy?
Jar!
Tony, how are you?
Excellent. Totally. You're talking to yourself?
No. My dad.
I understand.
That's Mary Murray and Jed Murray. No relation, I don't think, at the end of that clip there, as Jeremiah and Tony. And you also heard the voice of Lola Ruddy. I meant to warn you a little bit. Sorry about that. The language within it. It's very hard to choose a clip, it has to be said, Adam, within the script where there's not a bit of language. But I guess you were going for a kind of... There is a kind of gritty realism, and we get a sense there, even that's quite early on, of the kind of underlying violence that was part of the Canavan family, particularly when they were growing up, three boys and one girl. She had to watch a lot as a young girl, the character of Cass.
Yeah, so it was a harsh environment, and that's sort of where the trauma of the siblings is located. Mm. So they had to grow up in this really challenging, competitive, sometimes violent environment, but in spite of that, they still love each other. And that was the core of the film, is that we always look for stories that have a lot of heart in them, and we're not, things can get grim enough.
Yeah,
and we were
yeah.
interested in looking for a story whereby we could explore those familial bonds and how they can repair and regenerate.
And the mother has died quite early on. She's died in childbirth, actually, and that's another source of pain within the family, and pain within the father. You can see it there within him as well. But again, I was very struck by how even-handed you are, because even the father, who you can see there wasn't the easiest man to be dealing with, he has his reasons for being how he is.
Sure. I mean, played by the amazing Lola Ruddy, we were so lucky to have Lola involved in this film. Lola is an actor that we so admire. And I think even from the day he stepped foot on set, it really brought everyone's level up, because he brings this great authenticity and rigour to his work and sense of humour as well. And even the ideas that he was coming up, he had great understanding of from off the page and ideas to bring. So, I mean, that's really to the credit of Lawler and what he was offering us on set.
Yeah, and I mean, you keep talking about this collaborative aspect of it, and how much, because you had the location, you had the actors, you had the beginning of a story, so it sounds as if it was very much everybody, all hands on deck for doing that. But you couldn't pay for that location. I mean, North Sligo, Leitrim, that particular neck of the woods, the landscape that is in there, and you were shooting in January. Yeah. That, you know, Irish weather is not good at the best of times. How big a challenge was that aspect of things?
Well, we knew, as you said yourself, well, like, we were a micro-budget film, right? Mm. So we knew that in order to, like, expand the scope of what could be a very small story, we needed to use what was available to us. And the Horseshoe and the Gleniff and Mullaghmore and that area of North County is jaw-dropping. So you take this family story and you put it out in that setting as much as possible, and you're just unlocking this whole treasure trove of beauty, but also this rough, rugged, tactile adventure that this family goes
on. And who was the director of photography? Because obviously this had to be shot in a way that was that showed it off.
Yeah, the incredible Jas Foley, who has been a close collaborator of ours, a real rising star of Irish cinema, and he was lucky enough to come on the adventure with us. I live in North Sligo and 5 minutes from nearly every location in the film. So, yeah. I mean, it's really a love letter to Sligo in many ways. And I've been visiting Sligo, it's where my family are from, since I was born. So many of these views, I've been affected by them deeply. Yeah, and they're within my psyche, you know. So Jas, when he came up, he really understood that. And we took a lot of time visiting. And he was, even though I suppose we had ideas in our head, he was able to see them in a different way and offer things again in that collaborative process. But I think, like, people can't believe this is Ireland when they see it overseas, and they're seeing clips of it.
You shouldn't be telling people about that particular lick of, because it's the part where Leitrim, Donegal and Sligo all meet together, and you've got all of those three wonderful counties, and the three wonderful landscapes of them are present, you know, within a 5 minute walk kind of any particular spot along the way. I suppose I meant to mention, when we were listening to the clip with Laura Ruddy in it in particular, we heard Anna Malarkey's soundtrack happening underneath it there. I think she's is she an important collaborator within this whole system as well?
For sure. Similar to the landscapes, we had a very clear idea of the feel of the music we wanted. So we wanted to draw on those traditional foundations, but we didn't want to be confined by that. Mm. And Anna is somebody we'd been looking to work with for a long time. So she's a Galway native, but she has that traditional background, but placed in a contemporary musical setting.
Yeah.
And she just got the film immediately.
And there are two John Francis Flynn tracks used in it, Mole on the Ground, which is there a couple of times during the film, in fact. And then at the end, Come My Little Son. When you hear the story of the film, which is about the father and his sons, obviously, you hear the lyrics of that song in a totally different way. I'm kind of astonished at how you're kind of quite blasé about how you got this from the nub of an idea to actually being up on the screen. And on a Saturday night at Galway Film Fair, it's a huge step. What do you think was the key to it? For you, Edwin, first of all, what was the key to actually getting it from the two of you talking about it in the pub to it becoming a reality of being up there on the screen?
Yeah, I suppose it's all coming into focus, and I'm pinching myself a little bit this week, you know, that it's on Saturday night. It's a bit hard to believe. It's such a long journey making a film, and now it's mad that it's going to
be 2024, January 2024 was when you shot it. I mean, the fact that it's even out there now, that's quick in some ways, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so it's kind of strange. I suppose when you think of people call about guerrilla filmmaking, I call this kamikaze filmmaking because we literally had a date.
Well, you did survive it, thankfully.
Yeah, but we just jumped off, and then lots of people started coming, and we said we were going to do it, and we jumped off, and then lots of people kind of came to aid when we were on the descent, and I think someone attached a parachute and we landed somewhere safely in the end. But it was certainly that we just went for it, and I suppose we were egging each other on, and that's good to have such a great collaborator like Adam, where we don't really say no to each other if we want to do something together. So
yeah, so that leap of faith, is that the vital detail in all of this?
Yeah, well, like, at the same time, we had been talking about making the feature film for a long time, and it wasn't until our DOP, Jas Foley, he just went, stop talking about the thing and do the thing. So we did.
So it was your director of photography who said, look, talking isn't going to make it happen.
100%, yeah. He was the one that gave us that little push off the kamikaze cliff, as Ed put it.
Right. Well, listen, congratulations. Even on getting it made is already quite the achievement. But what you've done with it, I think, is something special. And I hope that the people who are there on Saturday night will enjoy it, and that it will get further legs. It's Saturday evening at 7 o'clock, I think we were saying.
Correct,
in the Town Hall Theatre. You can get to the screening. Good luck getting tickets, because it is sold out. But you never know. You could turn up. There could be returns on the door. Take the leap of faith. It's worked for the boys. And GIAF. No, not GAAF. That's if you're going to the International Film, the International Arts Festival. Filmfla.com is where you will get all of the details. And thanks too much. Thanks so much to both Adam and Edwin for being in with us. Adam O'Keefe and Edwin Milan for being in with us this evening. Lena Dunham changed the landscape for stories about young women with her HBO series Girls. Critically acclaimed, loved by the generation, she was proclaimed to be the voice of. Dunham felt burned out by life in New York and America and moved to the UK. There she found peace once more and she fell in love and got married. She's now back at the helm with a new Netflix series called Too Much, which may or may not be based on her own experiences of life and love in London for an American emigre. Starring Meg and Stalter, it's the story of Jessica, who encounters Felix in a down-at-heel London boozer. Felix is played by Will Sharp. You may remember him from series like Giri Haji and The White Lotus. He was also part of Jesse Eisenberg's film, A Real Pain. I caught up with Will Sharp recently, asked him about his work on Too Much, but let's start with a clip from the series where Felix, played by Sharp, and Jessica, played by Stalter, meet for the second time.
Sorry, how long have you been here again?
I got in today. I got here today.
What the fuck?
I know.
What are you doing in, like, South London without any of your friends?
Well, do you want me to tell you the truth? My ex-boyfriend and I split up 6 months ago because he couldn't see himself as, like, a father and a husband. And now he's engaged to, like, an online girl, like an influencer. She makes lip gloss.
Do you want me to murder them?
Yeah. I want you to cut their heads off and sew them back on as a lesson. I don't want you to fully kill them, but I'll root you on.
You're cold, by the way. Of course.
No, I run hot. Yeah. I'm, like, sweating.
Shall we walk?
Are you going to my house?
Well, I don't want you to get murdered on your first night in London.
It's really nice.
Megan Stalter as Jessica, Will Sharp as Felix in that scene from Too Much. Will Sharp, you are most welcome to Arena. That is probably the most unusual meet cute that I've come across. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, stars, you mean to go on. I love that they're brought together in such an idiosyncratic way. And I guess, like, in a literally messy way. And, like, that's one of the brilliant things I think about Lena's script is how, yes, it's romantic and it's funny and it's tender, but it's also not shy about, like, you know, the more, like, complicated realities of how it might feel to, like, enter into a relationship.
So. Yeah, it is one of the things that really struck me. But several of the scenes, particularly between yourself and Megan Stalter, the Jessica character, and the relationship that builds between them. I read somewhere that your character had been described less Hugh Grant in Notting Hill, more Hugh Grant's drunken roommate, Rhys Ifans. Of course, he plays the character of Spike. Did that strike you at all in the reading of it? He's certainly unconventional, is Felix.
Yeah, I suppose, like, he's not your typical sort of Prince Charming, as it were. And, like, there's lots of things. He's trying to be a better person. He's, you know, he's got clean recently and he's trying to write his own music and he's trying to sort of be the best version of himself. But as the series goes on and, you know, him and Jess get closer, a lot of his kind of compulsions and neuroses and vulnerabilities and a lot of, like, the baggage from his past life come back to sort of haunt him.
Yeah, and the other side of that is, of course, you have those serious aspects to the Felix character that they're in most of the, and certainly in the Jessica character as well. You know, this undertow under what you have to play. Can you even think about that type of balance, or are you purely playing the line and whatever effect it has, that's it?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, like, tonally, you know, Lena Dunham is so in command, I think, of her own voice. And she and the scene, you know, the scripts and her, I suppose that's where the tone is set. Mm. And within that, yeah, I think as an actor, you're just trying to figure out how's this character feeling in this moment. And, you know, why are they making these mistakes? Why are they saying these things? Or what has given them the courage to do the right thing? You know, and so I'm not really thinking about, is this funny or is this, do you know what I mean? It's almost like, well, just this is how it's feeling. And whether it's funny or not, it's down to the script.
Yeah, and in some ways down to the person watching who will decide whether they find it funny or not.
Yeah. This has all just been a series of red flags. I mean, when I came to find my English dream, I wanted to be in bed with, like, Mr. Darcy or Hugh Grant from the British Jones Diaries.
Okay, did you just say British... Did you say British Jones
Diaries? Yeah, there's four of them.
Yeah, it's not called British Jones.
She's British! She has a diary! What are you talking about? You're just some guy with a random girl's name tattooed to your ass. And you're just... You don't even have an electric bill. You don't even know the difference between polyamory and monogamy.
What is the difference? They sound exactly the fucking same.
It's really different. It's really different.
Lena Dunham's talked about, essentially we're talking about a young American woman in London. That's the story that's been told here and the kind of culture clashes that are involved in all of that. And Lena Dunham spoke about this drawing from her own experience of falling in love to the man she's now married to, in fact. And you have an interesting background in that regard. Now, I know you were only 8 when you moved from Japan, from Tokyo back to England. But have you a memory of any kind of culture clashes and dealing with that yourself as a youth, as a child, first of all, and growing into maybe your teen years, maybe more so?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, I think, takes a moment to learn the kind of social codes, I guess, of any, you know, new country, new city. But I felt like I had to, you know, I had family in England, but I'm kind of going to school here. I remember sort of taking a minute to kind of learn, oh, okay, so that's like kind of... ironic, I guess, or like that's what, you know, that means people are like shades being thrown and like next time you'll notice. And then just like silly things, like first time I played cricket, I held it up like a baseball bat, you know, things like that. But yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I think it took some adjustment. I think that's true of, you know, moving anywhere, at kind of at whatever stage of your life, really.
And I guess there's another aspect to that is when you did become an actor, I mean, somebody coming from the ethnicity that you come from, to what extent were you typecast and when did that break through? Because you seem to have broken through that mold, you know, that here's the East Asian actor, he will do this for us.
I mean, yeah, I suppose, you know, when I was first starting out, definitely the industry was less open-minded, for example, about period drama, you know, casting certain kinds of people in period dramas. And I did read for a lot of, you know, people sat at a computer on a spaceship, that kind of thing. I don't know. I think a lot of it is down to, you know, brave artists and actors like who before me, like, have made brilliant work. You know, even franchise films like Shang-Chi, I really felt like that did make a real difference to the way people thought. And so, yeah, we are now, I think, moving into a sort of era where people are a bit more open-minded, but yeah, it definitely does affect, you know, like the psychology of the, not just the actor, but also like the character that you're playing. It always is a factor to some extent, I think, even if it's not like front and center in the story.
Yeah, but you've recently, I think it's finished. I don't know if you're finished totally in the shooting of the new version of Amadeus, the Sky series, reuniting you with Joe Barton and Julian Farino, of course, of Giri Haji. But there you're playing Amadeus Mozart. How did you approach that?
You know, what was interesting was a lot of it was kind of, I found myself thinking a lot about his music and kind of it's the first time I've turned, well, I suppose apart from actually in this show in quite a different way, but it's the first time I've turned to somebody's music, you know, because there isn't really any footage of him or anything. Like, I'm trying to find clues about who he was underneath it all and how it felt to be him. And his music is so wide ranging. Like, some of it is really playful and light and cheeky, and then elsewhere there are just like huge grand dark operas. And that was like an interesting part of that job, was sort of like going to the music for clues.
Yeah, and of course, and you're not trying to impersonate Mozart, you're trying to be a character who happens to be Mozart in a play, a version. I'm just thinking too about the aspect there of the music within it. Music plays a huge role, as you say, in Too Much. And it looks to me as if you are actually playing. Was there a teenage rocker? Heavy metal, there's several forms you go through. Heavy metal, very indie, and introspective music there as well. All sorts of stuff.
I mean, I guess I was in, like, you know, as a teenager, I played in bands, but I've never played seriously. But I did, you know, it was a big part of it and part of it that I wanted to get right. So I did practice and work with Lou on his songs. And occasionally I, you know, tried to adapt the songs so I could play them and sing them as confidently as possible. And we pushed to play as many of the songs live as we could, which I think hopefully gives it like a kind of tactile realism. You know, that part of it was slightly scary, but also very fun.
Yeah. One final question, if I could, please. Because, I mean, talking to you as Will Sharp actor around too much, but Will Sharp director and writer is quite the thing as well. What about the, again, that ethnicity element of things? What can you do as a writer and director that perhaps you're, sometimes it's harder to do as an actor in that mode?
Well, I suppose, like, you know, trying to write from, I mean, even if it's in a subconscious way, you're writing, I think, from experience and, like, things that you have felt and thought will find their ways often into a script without, sometimes on purpose and sometimes without you realising. And a lot of what I write, I find, does seem to contain within it the experience of moving from Japan to England one way or another. And including in the project that, you know, I've been writing for Apple that I start shooting imminently, Prodigies, where, you know, a big part of that is my character's, you know, half Japanese heritage. So I suppose, like, you can do it consciously and with purpose, but I also feel like if you encourage and support writers from different backgrounds with different experiences, even subconsciously, their voices, you know, will be felt.
Well, looking forward to seeing that when it comes to our screens. Will Sharp, thank you so much for being with us on Arena this evening. And we'll finish with a clip of Will as the character of Felix and Megan Stalter once again as the character of Jessica. And we'll get a real sense of culture clash within this as we find out what the young American woman finds interesting in the London that she's walking around.
Oh my God, I love it. This is the London I came here for, the London I deserve. It's like out of a movie.
Yeah, a horror movie. Trust me, I grew up with the broken children of these houses and it's way more shining than it is Richard Curtis. I know they're sort of painted all fancy colours, but these people are full of pent-up rage and dark secrets.
I know, but yeah. Look, it's a yellow house.
Yeah, it's yellow.
Listen,
pretty.
Okay, so, you know, this is my boss, my new boss, and these are people that I work with, so I just wanted to let you know, like, let's just play it cool. Like, two normal people, cool as a cucumber, just me and you and... And, you know, I'm not trying to control you, of course. I wouldn't want you to control me. Like, I want us to feel free in this sort of whatever we're doing. You know, I want you to feel, like, free as a bird. But maybe we lose the hat.
Just be normal.
You know, just don't even think about the hat. It was never even on. It looks so nice.
There we go. Megan Stalter and Will Sharp in a scene from Too Much, which is available on Netflix from tomorrow. And we will be reviewing it on Friday night's TV slot. Glassworks by Philip Glass. It was made in 1981, a studio recording that was an innovative attempt to merge minimalism and pop, creating classical pieces with pop hooks, was how they put it. It soon became one of the composer's most popular works, Crash Ensemble, Ireland's leading new music ensemble and very familiar with the music of Philip Glass. First performed Glassworks in 2023. Delighted to be joined by artistic director Kate Alice, who has been playing cello with Crash Ensemble since 2002, collaborated with renowned artists like Bryce Dessner, Nico Muley, and recently Bono on his live stage show, Stories of Surrender. And delighted that Kate joins us, as I say, on the phone this evening. The music of Philip Glass, I mean, it's so important, really, Kate, to contemporary music, international contemporary music. What did he do, do you think, that changed the landscape? Or he was part of a set of people that changed the landscape in New York in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah. Hi, Sean. Nice to talk to you here and thank you for having me on. Yeah, as you say, he was part of a small collection of composers, sort of the downtown New York scene around the sort of late 1970s, 1980s, even earlier than that. And I think they sort of, between them all, they were sort of creating this world that reached out to dancers, it reached out to artists. It was sort of an invitation for lots of collaboration and an invitation for sort of all sorts of art forms being made.
Yeah, as you say, it went across theatre, went across dance, and particularly in the case of Philip Glass, it went across films that were kind of as much musical experiences as they were visual experiences in particular. Glass works then, this this, I don't know if he was kind of specifically looking to marry pop and classical, but he was certainly looking to grab a new audience for what might have been considered art music at the time.
Yeah, so he'd had a lot of success with sort of larger scale orchestral and opera, some of his operas, and he wanted to write something that would be more accessible to a wider audience. So it was actually intended, the piece Glassworks was actually intended as a studio recording, and it was released in 1982, I think, as both an LP and as a cassette. So the LP and the cassette each had their own separate mix, with the LP sort of intended for home listening and the cassette with a specific headphone mix, which was intended for Walkmans, which were kind of all the rage at the time.
Oh, they were the big thing in the 80s. The idea that you could walk around with these headphones on and listen to music was totally new, a totally new idea. Let's have a listen to a little bit of the from the opening movement, in fact. And I think this is your Ruth McGinley, who will be playing with you on the evening. This is her playing here. Let's have a listen, first of all. That is pianist Ruth McGinley there with the opening section of Glassworks, the piece that will be performed by Crash Ensemble this coming Saturday evening, if I have my dates correct, at the Pavilion Theatre, Saturday the 19th of July at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. And Kate Ellis, cellist and artistic director of Crash Ensemble, is with me on the phone this evening. You first performed, am I right in thinking, Kate, as in Crash Ensemble first performed Glassworks back in 2023. Bring us back to that moment in time, and I think it kind of shifted things in some ways for you in Crash Ensemble, did it?
Yeah, I think so. So I'd actually had the pleasure of hearing Glassworks played by the Philip Glass Ensemble, who were sort of the original performers of the piece. I had the pleasure of hearing them play that in New York in May of that year, I think. And kind of took the piece on board as something that Crash could play. So we played it as part of the Music Town Festival in July of that year, which is curated by Foggy Notions. And since we played it three times, I think, that weekend. And since then, we've had the opportunity to play it many, many times. Yeah. Actually, it's been sort of something that we've taken to different parts of the country. And it's something we've kind of... It's such a beautiful piece to play, and such a really lovely kind of listening for.
Yeah,
for
it's a very easy, and when I say easy listening, it's you can sit and just listen to it. You don't have to have 9 million bits of knowledge about Philip Glass to enjoy the music. And the piece that we heard there, the opening, is certainly it opens out with just the piano, as we heard from Ruth McGinley. But this is an ensemble piece, and it uses quite an interesting set of instruments, which is down to the Philip Glass Ensemble, I suppose, in some ways, the instruments of the people who were there at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you say, there's a sort of that beautiful piano solo that opens and actually closes the work as well. But then there we have lots of beautiful melodies from soprano saxophone, which is also kind of accompanied by the tenor saxophone. And then there's a flute part. And then there, in our version of the performance, there are four keyboards, which is sort of playing some of the string parts and some of the horn melodies. And we also have a vocalist who's kind of doubling some of the horn parts. So it's a really rich texture.
Yeah, I'd be very interested. I just want to give a sense of people, because there is such a moody feel in lots of ways to the opening section and the closing section, as you say. We heard the opening there just a while back. But I wanted to play the Philip Glass ensemble themselves, playing a little bit of one of my favourite movements from the work, so I'm just being selfish on this one, Flow, which has such excitement within it, I think, and also really shows off the wind section of the ensemble. Be fooled by a slow opening. It doesn't mean that it's going to stay that way. That's a little section from Flow, in the recording from the Philip Glass Ensemble, as I said. But Kate Ellis of Crash Ensemble is with me this evening. You mentioned vocalists, and even as I listened to the beginning of that, what would that sound like on a voice? And you mentioned these several keyboards that are involved. Does Philip Glass's music sort of open itself to that? Is he quite Catholic, if you like, in his expression of what instruments should or shouldn't play his pieces?
I think with this piece in particular, because it was created in the studio and it was sort of layered and, you know, different people came in at different times, etc. I think this piece is a little bit, obviously there's permission, but this piece is a little bit more open to interpretation. The reason for the voice is actually that the presentation of the piece that the Philip Glass Ensemble have. They have an amazing vocalist with them. So we obviously wanted to kind of include that in the mix. It gives this sort of beautiful kind of ethereal, you know, all those kind of, you know, those amazing rhythmical bits that you just heard there. Then kind of adding this sort of floaty ethereal voice on the top gives it a really beautiful quality.
Lovely mix. As I say, that's happening on the 19th, this performance of Philip Glass's Glassworks as part of Between the Notes. But Crash are very busy at the moment, particularly interested in what you're working towards at the Kilkenny Arts Festival. Sounds like an amazing project.
Yeah, so we have the pleasure of premiering a new opera, actually, at the Kilkenny Arts Festival. So it's an opera by an Indian-American composer, Kamila Sankaran, and with lyrics by Paul Muldoon, who I'm sure you know very well. And it's about the story of Savita and the Cork-born pirate, a few kind of centuries before, and Bonnie. And it's sort of interweaving their stories, both of their stories, with kind of a fusion of Irish and Indian classical music.
Yeah, Savita Halappan. So
that's going to be
quite exciting. Yeah, and is that completed and ready to go, or are you still in the process of developing some of it?
Yeah, no, we have the score, and we have the kind of everything set. They did sort of a showing of the opera, sort of a work in progress a few months ago. So that's all ready to go, but we will get stuck in then kind of at the end of July, actually the end of this month.
Yeah, and Skibbereen Arts Festival coming up towards the end of the month as well. Busy month ahead.
Yeah, busy summer.
Yeah, the music of Anna Mika here, is it?
Yeah, so we have a collaboration with Anna Mika, which was sort of based on her latest album and some new work, actually, that we have been working with our guitarist Barry O'Halpin, who sort of made some Crash, for want of a better word, had some crashed kind of arrangements of the material. So we'll be playing that at the Skivereen Arts Festival just before we go into rehearsals for.
And a final mention to the founder of Crash, an Irish premiere of one of his pieces, Donnchadh Dennehy, of course, an Irish premiere of one of his pieces coming up in September.
Yeah, so we're really excited about this one. We get to revisit our roots. So this concert-length piece, Land of Winter, that Donnchadh Dennehy has written, we will give the Irish premiere at the amazing festival in Cork, Sounds from a Safe Harbour, in September.
Well, sounds as if you have plenty to keep you occupied for the summer months, for
sure. Oh, we do.
Thanks so much for being with us this evening, Kate. That's Kate Ellis, Artistic Director of Crash Ensemble. Several events that she was telling us about there, but the nearest one coming to us very soon, performing Philip Glass's Glassworks as part of the Between the Notes Festival. That's on the 19th of July at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. I think I'm right in saying that, but you can find out full information about that and all of the gigs on crashensemble.com. And that's our lot for this Wednesday evening. Liam Murphy, Paula Shields researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Liam Mullen was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sian O'Gorman. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.